Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishing.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we've got two, I think, harbingers of spring.
Yeah.
Planting onions and the
smelling lilacs.
Bloom and the scent and the beauty and all that lilacs bring.
My first plant memory ever is of a lilac bush in my grandma's yard.
Yeah.
I was 3 or 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there and looked up at that thing. It was in full bloom. And I thought it was like 90 feet tall.
Yeah.
And that set the stage, I guess, for something.
The rest of your life.
50 years later,
yeah.
The bug came back. But I'll never forget my grandma's lilac bush. Yeah. Just fabulous.
I think grandmothers and memories and lilacs are things that that resonate for a great many people.
Sure did for me.
Yeah. Because so often, I mean, how many times have you heard people ask questions about, I want a lilac that is like the lilac that my grandmother had up north kind of thing. And for us, sometimes it's tricky to find those types of lilacs that are going to do well for us in Kentucky, Anna, for various reasons.
Because we ain't up north.
But yeah, people associate those memories.
And now, on the other hand, I'm not as big a fan of onions, but I'm...
I'm
learning.
Okay.
Janet sneaks them in on me.
I love onions.
And actually, when we were in Philadelphia at the flower show. I had finally, for the first time, a Philadelphia cheesesteak sandwich, whatever it is.
Oh, with all those grilled onions.
Smothered in onions. I loved it.
Yeah. And
absolutely
those are sweet.
Yeah.
I think they caramelize their onions, which brings out a sweetness.
Yeah, I'm coachable.
Good.
Coachable.
Pretty much every day there's an onion somewhere in a meal that I eat.
With your name on it?
It does, yeah. I mean,
Janine.
There's always onions in the house.
There's your onion.
And during a certain time of the year, they're my own homegrown onions.
Yeah.
And we'll find out a little bit more about how to properly do that with Bruce Frazier from Dixondale Farms. Actually, that's where I buy my onion sets from. And that came from a tip from a farmer's market person out in Shelbyville. And they were selling onions. And she's like, oh, honey, we get all our onions from there. They're fabulous. You know, so I started getting my onions.
It's a huge operation. Yeah. And it'd be fun to talk to them.
Yep. And Paige Dickey, she knows her lilacs. She is up in the Northeast where lilacs grow fabulously. She's got some tips on some good varieties of lilacs, from the vulgaris, the common lilac, to some of the hybrid and the Korean dwarf, like Miss Kim, a longtime favorite, about lilacs that we can grow well in Kentucky.
Yeah, she's a very nice lady, has this kind of quiet passion for gardening that comes through when you talk to her. And she'll talk about lilacs and what they mean to her and how to grow them here, how to prune them and so forth. So, and we can do it.
Yeah, we can, of course.
We can do it so people don't... Try lilacs.
That's right. So that's coming up on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stick with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, the simplest thing, everybody in the world, I think, has put their geraniums in the basement except me. Mm-hmm. Overwinter them, because you dig them up in the fall and you put them in the basement and then you take them out in the spring. And mine are doing great.
Oh.
I went down to visit them.
And are you surprised?
Well, no, because I'm a great gardener. But I'm happy.
Yeah.
Because I saved about 15 or 20 geraniums.
It's like reaffirmation, isn't it?
Yeah. And they can get expensive. And here they're down in the dark and they're huddled down there and you wonder how they're doing. I went down just this past week and gave them a little water and the green's coming up in the dark.
Yeah, I was going to say, are they pale?
Yeah, they're pale, but they're
still
not
green.
Yeah, they're not awful looking.
Uh-huh.
And they're anxious for spring like the rest of us.
Yeah.
So it works. So this fall, folks, dig up your geraniums, put them in a nice, dry, 50-degree place in the basement, water them on occasion. And I got my elephant
and
ears.
And wait for spring.
Yep. My elephant ears are down there.
Mm-hmm.
Alocasia, calocasia, they look great.
Good.
So it worked.
Your cannas?
Yes, ma'am.
Yep.
So I'm a happy
camper. I'm jealous of your root cellar. I would love to have a root cellar. Because that's such a fabulous place to keep things or to hide during a tornado.
It requires digging, though.
Some other. That's true. You didn't have to dig yours. It was already there.
How about the wish you stayed?
Well, happy Easter, first of all,
well,
Bob.
Yeah. Yeah.
Today's Easter, a little early. And I have to say that this unusually early Easter Sunday has foiled everything.
Uh-oh.
No asparagus for Easter for the first time that I can remember ever.
You're an asparagus impaired.
Always. Oh, because usually Easter's like in April or in the very end. We have one more Sunday in March.
Yeah.
And we always have asparagus from the garden for Easter brunch. That's what I contribute, well, among other things.
Is it the weather or are they mad at you?
It's the weather and it's the fact that Easter's so darn early.
Okay.
March 23rd?
Well.
my asparagus isn't ready, Jesus. So it's just one of those things that you mark. You mark your spring by some of these things, Bob.
Yeah,
and
you
it's
can tell.
It's unsettling.
You're going to blame the big guy.
What does it mean about the rest of the season?
I think lightning is going to stalk the land here. If you know,
the cicadas are coming again this year too.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. Maybe we did piss somebody off. So yeah, no asparagus yet. There's some little spears starting to poke through a little bit, but not nearly enough for a harvest to feed. People for Easter brunch.
Memorial Day.
Yeah.
What else? Arbor Day is coming up.
It has to be Easter.
Yeah, Arbor Day asparagus.
It has to be Easter.
I'll send you some.
All right. It's still not the same. All right. What's going on around town, Bob? Speaking of the cicadas.
Yeah. And this is the bad news, I guess. The largest brood of 17-year periodical cicadas since about 1991 will be emerging this April and early May. Mm-hmm. And get ready, folks. The Jefferson County Extension Service is sponsoring several workshops on protecting tender trees and shrubs, which is a problem. And the first one will be March 25th at 7 o'clock at the Louisville Nature Center. Second one, April 9th at 7 o'clock at the Highlands Shelby Park Library, with more to follow. But see the Homegrown page for other meetings about this. But yeah. They did some damage last year. And are they ever noisy?
It's
the last time, I'm sorry.
Yeah, 2004. It was a different brood that emerged then.
Yeah. This was 14.
This is brood 14.
They keep track.
And this one they're saying, because we didn't have considerable problems out at our places in 2004 like they did in town.
Right.
But this year and this brood is a widespread statewide emergence, so everybody will likely be impacted. And there indeed can be some serious damage done to your young plants.
I'm depressed.
So, yeah.
How about some good news about sustainable city stuff?
Right. This is good news. Our friends at the Urban Design Studio, along with the University of Louisville and the College of Design at the University of Kentucky, another one of their Sustainable City Series workshops. It's going to be held Tuesday, March 25th at 6 p.m. at Glassworks, which is, you know, on Market. And this particular Sustainable City Series is Local Food and Agriculture. Tuesday, March 25th, 6 p.m. at Glassworks. They do ask that you RSVP because these events, remember that last one that I was a part of? Oh my gosh, so many people showed up and people were, the energy there, it was so exciting. They do a great job. It's fabulous information, good networking, all of that. So, yes, that will lift your spirits knowing that the cicadas are coming.
So will the discussion of lilacs.
So will the discussion of lilacs, because that says spring for sure.
And we've got just the person to talk to about this. Paige Dickey is the author of 5 gardening books, many magazine articles, is a board member of the Gardening Conservancy, and also gardens with her husband at their home in North Salem, New York. She's with us today to talk about her books and a recent article in Horticulture Magazine called The Next Classic Lilacs. Paige, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
I ran across your article in Horticulture Magazine, and I'm a lilac lover since I was a little kid, and it just kind of struck me. And obviously, they have you, too. Can you kind of give our listeners a sense of what your garden's like and how many lilacs you have and where do you live?
Well, I live actually in the countryside, 60 miles north of New York City. It used to be Zone 5. Now I think it's more like Zone 6A.
Right.
And one of the few things that was here when I bought the property 27 years ago were lilacs. Syringa vulgaris, the old-fashioned lilac. And it's an old farmhouse, and I'm sure they've been here for many, many decades. And, of course, they're wonderful. But then I started to collect Asian lilac species that have become available, and I have fallen in love with the whole lilac family.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. In fact, you began your article, "I am tired of reading articles disparaging the lilac."
Yes.
And it goes uphill from there. So give us a sense of, you know, kind of the vulgaris and some history of that in this country.
Well, you know, it's not native, but the colonists brought the lilac here. I mean, it's originally from China and Japan, but they brought it here. So it's been here for a number of centuries, and so, in fact, it feels like one of our indigenous plants. Mm-hmm. And as you know, even though you're down in Louisville, it's very hardy. So you see it up in New Hampshire and Vermont. as well as down, you know, in southern states. Mm-hmm. And what the magazines have always said about the old-fashioned lilac is that it had a kind of awkward shape, and that when it was humid in the summer, the leaves got full of mildew, and so maybe it wasn't a great shrub to grow. And what I was saying in the article was that there are many different kinds of lilac mm-hmm. that don't have mildewy leaves and are fantastic garden plants. But I wouldn't be without the old-fashioned lilac just for its extravagant flowers and fragrance.
And fragrance, yes. I think to a certain degree as well, Paige, the when the lilac came south, if you will,
yes.
that's when some of the more notorious problems became
noticeable.
But part of it, too, I think, because I remember my dad always talking about this, because he grew up in Illinois, and up there, colder, that sort of thing, but more consistent in the winter. So in Kentuckiana, we would get a warm up in March and then another freeze or another.
Exactly.
So our lilacs would swell and then some weather would come along and knock them back, and then we wouldn't get any bloom, where the more northern folks would stay good and cold consistently and then have that beautiful show. So I suppose some of the advice that we'll be seeking from you today will be what kind of lilacs might hold off a little bit better in terms of swelling and blooming, so therefore be a little bit better for us here in Kentuckiana.
Yeah, you mentioned four standouts in your magazine article. Let's take them one at a time.
Okay.
And that way we can just kind of walk through this thing. The first one you mentioned is the Chinese lilac, the Syringa
chinensis.
Talk about that.
I love this plant. It's a big shrub, like the common lilac, in that it gets, at least 8 feet high and 6 feet wide. But it's twiggier and much more graceful. It has more delicate flowers, not as quite as showy as the common lilac, but with the same fragrance, and the shrubs just cover themselves with these very graceful flowers.
Hmm. Any cultivars in particular of the chinensis?
The interesting thing about chinensis and the real difference between it and the common lilac is that it doesn't come in a great variety of colors. It really comes in two colors. One is a lavender purple, which is beautiful, and the other is a white, which in fact has a slight lavender tinge to it, but it is almost white. So it doesn't have the hybrid cultivars that you see in mm-hmm. the regular lilac.
Okay. And then you mentioned the little leaf lilac, the superba, I think.
What used to be called the Daphne lilac, Microphyllis superba. And it's very different in that it's fairly low, about 6 feet high, and quite wide spreading. I have it on a bank, maybe five or six of them on a bank, and it does very nicely on a sunny bank. It has much smaller leaves. They don't get mildew. Beautiful flowers that start out, the buds are a garnet color, and then they become pale pink. It's intensely fragrant. And the really neat thing about this shrub is that it reblooms in August.
Oh.
And people who come to my garden say...
I've experienced that with our superba, yeah.
Have you?
Yes.
They say, what is that
uh-huh.
blooming? It can't
That's
be
nice.
A lilac, and of course it is.
It's got a very nice, open, sort of graceful, while being like a little untamed as
yes.
well. It's
yes,
weird.
It does.
It's a combination of it all.
Yeah.
It's a nice one. Paige, in terms of the flowers and like the distinction of the flower type, the little leaf lilac, the superba that you were just talking
yes.
about, some of the dwarf Korean lilacs like Miss Kim.
Oh,
they
yeah.
seem to have smaller blooms as a part of their larger
some
cluster.
Some of them do. The little leaf lilac, yes, has a smaller bloom, but it's not a lot smaller, and
mm-hmm.
it's very showy.
Mm-hmm.
It only comes in that one color, but it's a very showy shrub when it's blooming. Now, there are two more that that I think are just the perfect, two more species you just mentioned that I think are the perfect shrubs for the garden. And one is called Miss Kim, and it's widely available in nurseries. And the other is called the Dwarf Korean, or Palabiniana. The Dwarf Korean lilac has tiny flowers, dark green leaves, not much bigger than a thumbnail. And it only gets about 5 feet high. It clips beautifully and is just a mass of blooms when it flowers. You often see standard topiaries of it, which are perfectly gorgeous in the garden.
Right.
And then the other favorite is Syringa patula Miss Kim. And it has bigger flowers, not quite as big as the old-fashioned lilac, but bigger flowers that actually pale to a pale blue, intensely fragrant, smaller leaves, and it turns a gorgeous color in the fall. It's a rather graceful shrub to about 6 or 7 feet. And it is a stunning shrub at any time of year.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier the you have some favorites. I have two I like. One of them is Juliana Hers, a weeping lilac. Maybe you've seen that.
I don't know that lilac.
It's gorgeous. Mine was about 10 feet tall and 10 feet across and wept. And I'd wept when I was looking at it.
Oh, I bet you did.
Until the wind blew it over, and then I cried. And then there's the cutleaf one.
Well, I was wondering, Laciniata, I think it is. And that probably does very, very well for you.
It does. Blooms early and not a hint of mildew.
I
love it.
And again, small leaves and a real gracefulness about it.
So can we talk a little bit about the maintenance of lilac? Because I think that's one of the things that confounds people as well. And, you know, with this mention of no powdery mildew, one of the, you know, ways in which to avoid that mostly is to make sure that your lilacs are taken care of properly and planted out in full sun. You know, so that's part of it, just
well,
in terms of culture.
Full sun is key.
So what do people need to do to keep their lilacs healthy, blooming, and looking good year after year?
Well, as you know, the common lilac, the old-fashioned lilac, blooms whatever you do to it. I mean, you see these abandoned stands of it, and it's just they're blooming their head off. So it is a myth that you have to deadhead for it to bloom well the next year. That's not true. On the other hand, a certain amount of pruning certainly does help the shrubs. For one thing, if you're going to prune, you might want to open up the shrub a little bit, but if you're going to cut branches of lilacs, either do it with the idea of bringing big bouquets in the house, or do it right after they bloom, because lilacs set their buds for next year's bloom shortly after they bloom. And one way of opening up old lilac stands to get more air coming through them is to take out some of the oldest branches right at the ground. And I would certainly do that immediately after they bloom.
So a little attention every year will make it less daunting.
But that's the common lilac. These other kinds that I just talked about, Miss Kim and the Dwarf Korean and the Little Leaf Lilac and the Chinese Lilac, really don't need any care at all. They can be pruned, but I have never seen them have any kind of disease, and I don't really prune them much.
Well, Paige, I can't let you go without talking about your books, too. I love just the titles of them, Gardens in the Spirit of Place, Dogs in the Garden, and Cats in the Garden. Let's kind of take those one at a time.
Okay.
What's Garden in the Spirit of Place about?
Well, it's about gardens, and actually even the houses that these gardens surround, that were made with a great sensitivity to the surrounding landscape, to the climate, to the culture and history of the place where they were. In other words, really appreciating where you live and having that influence the kind of garden that you do.
And then Dogs and Cats in the Garden. It sounds like kind of fun.
Well, they were just silly fun books. that I did, and actually they're about dogs who happen to live in very fine gardens and in the same or with serious gardeners,
right.
And then profiles of cats who.
So it's sort of like the dog that you want to be reincarnated as. So my family always said, I want to be reincarnated as a wishy animal.
Well, most dogs and cats, as you well know, adore gardens.
Yes.
I mean, they're not always good to them, but they adore them.
But they can learn.
Do the cats...
And if you're a gardener, it's nice to have animal companions with you.
Indeed.
Yeah. Did your cats talk to you?
Only when they want food.
Okay. Well, it's been a delight. Thank you very much, and I hope some listeners are encouraged now to go out and try some lilacs because they're just great to have.
Thank you.
Paige Dickey is a gardener in North Salem, New York, and author of the Horticulture magazine story, The Next Classic Lilacs. For more information on Paige, her books, or lilacs, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Bruce Fraser and the Onions of Dixondale Farms. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3. WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishing.
I'm Bob Hill.
And it's onion planting time, Bob.
Says who?
Says the calendar.
Okay.
It's mid-March. This is when you
right.
plant your onions. Do you grow onions?
We're going to start again. This year, we're going back in the vegetable garden business. I made
Good.
A vow to do that.
Good.
And onions will be in there because I like bad breath.
Yes. And with the price of fuel and everything else,
I may burn onions.
It's really smart to start growing your own food it's going to get more expensive.
Tastes better?
Yeah, it does taste better for sure. And if you are indeed interested in growing onions, you won't want to miss our next guest. Bruce Fraser is joining us as onion planting season approaches. So pay attention, Bob. Bruce Fraser's the president of the family-owned and operated Dixondale Farms, where they've been growing onions in Carrizo Springs, Texas since 1913.
Wow.
Today, the farm's considered the largest and oldest onion farm in the United States. They have over 300 acres of seedlings, and it's early spring, so they're likely busy getting ready to ship to onion growers all over the country, including myself. I'm waiting for my onions.
Okay.
Looking forward to seeing what Bruce has to say in terms of the best way to plant them, grow them, and harvest them. Bruce, thanks for taking the time to join us, and welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. The business has been around since 1913, and it seems as though you married into it, your wife's family. But how long have you actually been involved in growing onions at Dixondale Farms?
Since 1982.
Okay.
So that's 25 years, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they really don't care that much about me, but they want some cheap labor. So
exactly.
The family put me in charge.
That's why women marry, after all.
That's right.
So you've been involved in it since 1982, and I noticed there were some shifts in the way that you all looked at the way you were doing business since then. So can you sort of talk about the evolution of the business, you know, traditionally as growing onions and selling onions, to being a resource for gardeners like myself? Bob said he's going to grow onions this year, you know, so that we can get some of the good stuff. I mean, why the shift?
Well, the shift was back in the 80s, we saw the demand for the onion plants or our product still being there. We saw possibly the distribution system breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
Back before then, in the 70s and early 80s, we would go into a produce house and take onion plants in there, and then they would sell them to a bunch of peddlers that mm-hmm. would run them around and take them out to the farm and garden stores around the area, and or people that were planting onions would come and pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we saw was that they didn't want to inventory anything, which is the case still today mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants it right at the time in which everybody else wants it. So they were cutting down on their volume and things of that nature. And so we decided to use UPS as our delivery system.
So sort of, you know, like advances in technology, if you will, like UPS, kind of allowed for a new look at your business. So just selling the seedlings straight away to the customer from the field.
That's correct. And we use the Postal Service quite a bit, too.
Mm-hmm.
We ship about 400 million onion plants a year.
Holy cow.
And so the UPS, what we're able to do is, because of the volume that we do, we actually truck them in our trucks to the various hubs mm-hmm. that UPS has around the country.
Sure.
We drop them into that hub, and then they're delivered the next day out of that hub.
Wow.
To the various customers. So uh-huh. they stay in our refrigerated reefers the entire time, and it just usually takes 1 or 2 days to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they get out, though, it's a lot better than UPS trucking them in their vans that aren't refrigerated and
right.
things of that nature.
You can sort of maintain control over the product for longer periods
exactly.
of time.
Exactly. I say that, the clock doesn't start ticking until they leave that refrigeration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bruce, what's the production schedule like? I mean, take us kind of through a season of shipping onions.
Onions being, usually it's the first thing people can put in their gardens.
Mm-hmm.
So we start shipping onion plants actually in October, and we ship those into South Florida, South Texas, Southern California, Arizona. And then as the year progresses, then end up shipping them, slowly farther northward.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas in the month of April, it's our busiest month for the mail order end. And it sort of works out fine because in November, December, January, we still ship to garden centers, the Walmarts, the big box companies somewhat,
mm-hmm.
and as well as the Vidalia, Georgia farmers.
Mm-hmm.
We ship about, somewhere around 50 million plants to Vidalia every year.
Well, now these are grown in greenhouses or outdoors or both?
They're all grown outdoors, field grown. Our farm is 2,200 acres, and of that 2,200 acres, 350 of it are the onion transplants. They're all hand harvested.
Wow.
We have 350 employees that are, God bless them, hardest working. And they bunch the onions themselves out in the field.
Wow. Yeah.
So basically you've got seedlings growing all the time, I would suspect.
And except,
so that they're ready to harvest.
We finish up onion plants in May,
uh-huh.
and then we grow a lot of cantaloupes,
mm-hmm.
just regular cantaloupes for the, grocery store chains,
sure.
Kroger's and things like that of the world.
Uh-huh.
And we do that in June and July. And, in August, it's not the 120 degrees days down here that bother you. It's the 105 degree nights. We try not to grow anything in the month of August. So
there you go.
That's about the only time in which we slow down a little bit.
Okay. So, Bruce, then... since all of those, that 350 acres of seedlings that's being grown, they're being harvested and shipped to people like me, when are they actually planted? And are they planted from, are those little okay. seedlings planted from seed out in your field?
Exactly. I take from the seed to the plant.
Uh-huh.
We start planting in August. We
okay.
finish planting in February. So there's a stagger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What are the keys is to have the right varieties ready at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And it generally takes about 90 days for me to take it from the seed to the plant.
Okay.
And then it's just about the size of a pencil, and that's when we ship it to customers like yourself.
Mm-hmm. So how many different varieties of onions are there that you're growing?
We actually, this year, we have 35 different varieties.
Mm-hmm.
In our catalog, I think we offer 22, and the other ones are going to commercial growers.
Bruce, at our end of the UPS truck, talk some about the length of day required for onions. It's not
sure.
so much temperature as day length.
The size of the onion bulb, okay, depends upon the number and size of green leaves or the tops, okay? For each leaf, there's a ring of onions. And the bigger, the larger the leaf, the larger the ring. Here's a trivia question. The perfect onion has 13 rings.
Hmm.
Huh.
So
you want 13 leaves.
Yeah, that's what you want. So the onion first
forms a top, okay, and then depending upon the onion variety and the length of day, they start to form the bulb from the leaf base.
Mm-hmm.
Those carbohydrates that are in the leaves are transferred to the rings of onions. So the key is to grow as much top that you can until that date that bulbing process begins.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So onions are categorized in three different categories: long day, intermediate day, and short day. Short day onions are the onions that we grow in the South, such as the Vidalia, mm-hmm. the Texas 1015, some of the old white Bermudas, some of the old varieties. Those take only 10 to 12 hours a day length before they start the bulbing process.
Okay.
Whereas the intermediates are in the 12 to 14 hours,
uh-huh.
and the long days are the ones that are grown in the north,
uh-huh.
and they're from 14 to 16 hours.
So is it safe to say that in Kentuckiana we're mostly intermediate day?
Intermediate day. We've got a variety called Candy, that's probably our most popular variety now, and it fits in. It's great when you're in an intermediate day because you can sort of play with, you can have intermediate and long day actually there in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you can grow some varieties that are sweet, but also the long day generally store better, and you can grow some storage varieties also.
Because I wanted to ask you about that as well, because last year I got your all's intermediate day sampler.
Mm-hmm.
This year I got the long day sampler because of the storageability issue.
That's right.
Okay.
Right.
So likely I'll be able to store the onions that I grow this year a little bit longer than the ones that I had last year.
Absolutely. What makes an onion sweet is how much water's in it,
mm-hmm.
okay? What makes an onion rot is how much water's in it.
I gotcha. The sweeter it is, the more rotten it is.
If you get the long-day storage types, generally are more pungent,
okay.
But they're going to be more solid fiber. They're not going to have as much water in there,
right.
and therefore they're going to store better.
Well, Bruce, to that end then, how's the gardener here prepare to put the sets in?
Okay. Well, the plants, they're best planted on a raised bed. Okay. Some people, if you've got container gardening, that's an excellent method. But, the soil, hopefully, it needs to be a well-drained, fertile soil. Ideally, the pH runs about ideal for onions, about 6.8.
Okay.
So actually there in Kentucky, you have fairly acidic soils. So, y'all may need to add some lime to it to get it around that 6.8.
Mm-hmm.
They require a good source of really the NPK and just that planting. If you think about it, that phosphorus and potassium are primarily going to be used for root development.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to what we talked about, growing leaves, growing foliage, that means nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get a good source of balanced fertilizer down at planting, then after that, pretty much all you need to do is feed it nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So even just working in a good amount of compost and manure will likely do the trick.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
Are there any kind of pest problems you should look for?
Well, onion thrips are the biggest pest. They are look almost like maybe a small flea. And what they do is they bite into the leaf and suck out the juices. And by doing that, they put a lesion or a mark there, which makes disease easier enter into the leaf.
Yeah, I think I had a touch of that last year.
Yeah, you can usually tell. You uh-huh. just go out there and cup your hand underneath the leaves and sort of bat it.
Yeah.
If you look down, you'll see them. They're little white things, and they turn black.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, I think they're born pregnant, so they multiply through that.
Nature. So, Bruce, what about water requirements for onions? I know, certainly we want well-drained soil so they don't rot since they're bulbs.
Right.
But I know that there are better times for watering than others
right.
in terms of their development.
And, generally speaking, an onion requires about, from the transplant, about 20 inches of rainfall, okay? And I'm pretty simple guy, so I tell people to use the knuckle rule. They like a lot of frequent, shallow waterings. Do not water overhead.
Okay.
That's the worst thing you can do to an onion crop. Why? because you're wetting the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, that leaf, whatever bacteria, whatever disease is created in that leaf, when those carbohydrates are transferred from the leaves into the rings of onion, they're going to transfer that bacteria, and therefore you're going to have onions rotting during storage.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Okay? So okay. I say use the knuckle rule. If you put your finger into the dirt and you come up with wet soil before you get to your first knuckle, that is probably wet enough. Onions have about 200 roots, and they'll extend out as much as 18 inches away from the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And where the bulk of the roots are in the top 1 to 2 inches of the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So they're fairly shallow rooted, but they don't like to get, I'd say they don't like to keep their feet wet.
Gotcha. Yeah.
They like to take a drink, take it up, put on some growth, and then sort of dry down again.
Okay.
Well, can you manipulate the flavor somehow by gardening techniques?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. The, once back to those things, you know, more water's in it.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to pump it up with water and then if you put more water and nitrogen in there, the plant's going to take up more water, and that's going to it's going to manipulate it somewhat.
Yeah.
But primarily, it's in the variety.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you can make them a teeny bit sweeter or teeny bit hotter.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, when the onion starts bulbing, if you want onions to store better, then,
once
that bulb gets out to a particular size, if you cut off the water, you're going to have the onions going to be store better. If you want it sweeter, you give it some more water.
All right. Good tip. I want mine to store longer, I think. Although, I pretty much went through most of my onion crop before I could prove any long-term storageability, so that's why I ordered more this year.
You only cry when they're gone.
That's right.
The thing about that is, you know, the plant onions, if, you know, we plant them about every 4 inches.
Okay.
Well, we talk about the separation. The reason being is that a 4-inch onion is a pretty good-sized onion.
Mm-hmm.
If you plant them 2 inches, they're going to get to be 2 inches.
Right.
So whatever spacing you put is what the spacing's going to be. Now, if you plant them, we put on top of a bed that's 20 inches wide, we put two lines. They're 4 inches down the line, and there's about maybe 12 inches in between the two lines of onions. Now, if you plant them in a container garden, it's best to plant them about every 7 inches, separated 7 inches where it says solid onions, something like, you know, the ones they make out of timber and things of that nature.
Right.
How about the harvesting and the curing?
Well, the main thing is that when the onions, they'll tell you when they're done.
Okay.
The tops fall over. You know, people ask, well, can I go out there and knock the tops over? Sure you can. And that will end the cycle.
Yeah.
Once that onion sort of pinches that neck off, then it can't transfer any more of those carbohydrates from the leaves to the rings. So it stops. Okay? And the best thing to do is to make sure that top, when it falls over, that means full maturity. Let that top dry down, and for long-term storage, the best thing to do is just take your finger and your thumb, and when you run across the top there and squeeze right there at the neck, when you no longer find any moisture, then those onions are ready to clip that top off.
Okay. You want it basically to seal itself up there,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Once again, that neck, a good tight neck, will keep any air from getting down inside the bulb, and it'll make them last a lot longer.
Okay. So, curing, I know that what you just described there, that closing off of the neck is extremely important if you want them to store well, but also the curing process is necessary. How does one go about properly curing onions for storage?
Well, when you lift them, when that top falls over, you lift that onion out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Place the leaves of one onion over the bulb of another and vice versa.
Oh, yeah.
That way they're laid out and they're protected from the sun.
Uh-huh.
But those onions should sit out, hopefully you're not going to get any rain during this critical spell.
Mm-hmm.
But they can sit out there for about 5 or 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, when you can grab the top of the onion and twist that top off with your hands, then they're ready to be clipped off.
Okay. But usually
they're good and dry at that time.
Like a week to 10 days, sort of drying out,
that's
ideal. Okay. Storage-wise, I would love it if I had a root cellar, but a lot of people don't have root cellars anymore. Bob's got a root cellar in his old farmhouse.
Yep.
But just store them in the refrigerator, store them cool.
What I recommend is we use probably the old-timers. Remember, used to put them in our grandmother's, you know, pantyhose.
Uh-huh.
And you drop one in, tie a knot, and then drop another onion, and yep. You hang it up on a rafter.
All right.
Well, we sell a little mesh netting, but I tried to sell used pantyhose no one would buy, so I ended up with you going with the mesh netting.
Grandma was hollering at you.
That is one of the key things, and then you know, the onions aren't touching each other.
Okay.
Anyone knows the problem with storing it, if you store them in a container with all of them touching it, once one rots,
the whole lot
then
rots.
It touches the next one, and the next one rots, and it goes through the whole bushel.
Thank you so much, Bruce. We really appreciate your time. We know this is a busy time of the year, and I will be waiting for my onions and leeks to arrive.
Hey, man, you know your onions, man.
Start getting spring so we can sell some up there.
Yeah, no kidding. I hear you. Thanks very much, Bruce.
You're welcome.
Bruce Frazier is the onion man and president of the family-owned and operated Dixondale Farms. They're located in Carrizo Springs, Texas, and grow about 36 different varieties of onions on over 350 acres. They dig and ship daily, so keep checking the mailbox. For more information on Dixondale Farms and onions, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few tear-free listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
I was all right for a while. I could smile for a while. But I saw you last night. You held my hand so tight as you stopped to say hello. Oh, you wished me well. You couldn't tell that I've been crying over you, crying.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And we've got a couple of questions, so let's get to them, Bob.
Yes, ma'am.
How about if I ask you this one?
Please.
Because I know that you have embraced your Creeping Charlie, so maybe you can teach these people to embrace it as well.
I'm one with my Creeping Charlie.
Okay, this one's from Aaron. Dear Bob and Janine, spring is almost here, which means our backyard will soon be covered in Creeping Charlie. Our actual grass is very sparse, and the lawn really needs extensive repair. I know fall is the optimal time for reseeding, but is there anything that we can do in the coming months to sort of facilitate a healthier lawn? They really, really, really don't want to use herbicides. So
I had the same problem last year, and I hired the Chuck Police at $20 an hour.
The what?
Chuck Police.
What's that?
Creeping Charlie.
Oh. And what did they do for $20 an hour?
They got Charlie out of the neighborhood.
How?
You dig it out by hand. There's no other way to do it. I mean, you might want to use, if you don't want to use herbicides,
right.
You cannot talk to it. You can't be nice to it.
You can't.
You dig it out or call the Chuck Police and see if they'll get it for you.
Yeah. Or you embrace it.
That's
right?
What I do.
Yeah.
If it's green, it's growing parts of my acres, I say, fine.
Right. And like the thing.
Sorry.
The thing I wonder in terms of, and we don't have this information in front of us, but the actual grass is very sparse, they say.
Yeah.
So is it shady? I mean, it's been my experience that Creeping Charlie likes moist, shady areas. Is that not true?
Yes.
So it's likely shady, and you're never, ever going to get a really good stand of grass in a shady area, right?
That's a good point.
Thank you.
I mean, garden. Just put something else in there.
Yeah. Like, so dig it, get rid of it, you can use corn gluten for 3 years. And chip away at, you know, any sort of reseeding that may happen. Change the area altogether.
Yeah,
put mulch down, put pea gravel down, make a sitting area.
Exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
But if it's a sunny area, then if you get a healthy lawn established, you can choke out your Creeping Charlie or make it a little bit more difficult. But yeah, you got to just get out there and pull it all the time.
Or call the Chuck Police.
Or call the Chuck Police.
Question for Miss Wishy.
All right.
We'd like to try growing the Three Sisters in our garden this year for fun.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't been able to Google up any information on this old-time Native American companion. That's right up your alley, kid. The planting of corn, squash, and beans.
Mm-hmm.
Yours in Dirt, Bill Carner.
Bill Carner. They are indeed called the Three Sisters, corn, squash, and beans. They were often planted together, again, sort of like mixing up the crops that has been in conversation lately here on Homegrown as a good planting technique. Not necessarily companion planting in that old style, but just diversification in your garden makes it harder for disease and pest problems to spread. The theory behind corn, squash, and beans is the Three Sisters. Squash covers the ground, so it's kind of becomes this living mulch.
Yeah.
Chokes out weeds. The beans fix nitrogen in the soil, right? So it's a good exchange of fertility.
You go, girl.
The beans also do what, Bob? They climb up the stalks of
the
corn, beans, and squash. So it's a good way to use the plants for fertility as well as for trellising, if you will, with the corn, that sort of thing. Then as the corn grows, it starts to shade the squash by the summer. Do you know what I mean? So it's a nice little symbiotic relationship.
Why couldn't it be the three brothers?
It could be the three brothers, but most
feel better about that.
Most American Indian people view these sorts of life-giving things in a female sort of way.
Because we take care
of those things.
With reason.
That's right.
Good point.
And in fact, most of the fields were owned by women if it was a matrilineal society. So
get out of here.
Might be some of it as well.
Boy.
We controlled the food. We still control the food because if Janet didn't cook, you wouldn't eat.
So much for the good old days.
Yeah, really. So yeah, that's the basics of it. There's not anything super duper crazy about it.
I got one more question for you related to all things onions.
Sure. Good.
I have a question about growing onions.
Mm-hmm.
I brought some red onions that are already sprouting at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
Can I plant them in the garden just as they are? Should I separate them into sections? How much space should I leave between them?
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate any tips you might have. Lauren Freed.
Lauren, I would not necessarily plant onions from the grocery store that have sprouted.
I agree.
Couple of reasons why. They'll likely just rot because they've already formed that bulb. You're better off planting the little slips that are basically like little onion plants.
Right.
So they haven't bulbed yet.
Yeah.
Also, many of the onions that you buy at the grocery store have been treated with a like retardant, right? Like a
exactly.
sprouting
yeah.
something or other so that they don't sprout more than they already have sprouted, right?
Right.
So I would just eat your onions. And you can still eat your onions even if they've sprouted a little bit. It's no big deal. So eat your onions and order real onion slips from Dixondale or whoever else, or go down to Bunton's or your corner hardware store and buy onion slips and plant them that way. Right now, in fact, you can plant your onions right now as we speak.
You got it.
Okay.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246. Onion.
I am getting so excited about onions, potatoes, and leeks. I can barely contain myself.
I can tell.
I'm sorry.
All right.
Latin word of the week this week, Bob.
Is onion related.
It is. Sorry.
I don't leave the room here.
Sorry about that.
Do this by yourself. I'm
Aliasius. Aliasia.
Is a liar.
Aliasium.
People who tell lies are aliasiums.
Oh, aliasius is like onion or garlic in flavor or appearance.
Okay.
Okay. So, for example, flaspy. Can you say flaspy five times?
I'll say it once. Flaspy.
Flaspy aliasium.
The roadside pennycress.
Roadside pennycress.
Sure.
Petiveria aliasia.
The guinea henweed.
Guinea henweed. Pelteria aliasia.
Good old garlic cress.
That
one I know.
Yep. Mansoa aliasia.
The garlic vine.
Thulbhasia aliasia.
That's an island in the South Pacific. Also, society garlic.
You've heard it. Mom used to grow society garlic.
Yeah.
It's very pretty. So, obviously, all of these plants, the roadside pennycress, guinea henwood, garlic cress, garlic vine, society garlic, all have something onion or garlic-like in their flavor or appearance.
And their aliases?
And their aliases.
They have false names and IDs.
I guess you could say that as well. Yeah. A little trickery. Oh, well, so if you see that, you will know that, you know, perhaps it's not a done deal for sure. Perhaps you could use it as an alternative to real garlic or onion, or maybe you should just enjoy it as a plant.
I'm just working on onions right now. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us once again next week for the show.
Homegrown is produced by the very social Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.